Okay, let's get started. Let us get started. Hey, Bailey. Okay, so we are all here and ready. Somewhat ready. John, will you go grab a couple Bibles? Does everybody have a Bible that needs one? We can grab a couple. Is there anybody that John needs to grab a Bible for? Never mind. Then we're good. Let me pray, and then we'll jump right on in. Father, we just thank you for your grace, for your glory. We thank you that you have revealed yourself to us in your word, that you have revealed yourself to us through your son, Jesus. And so, Lord, as we seek to see you and know you and delight in you, Lord, please, we ask as we turn to your word, Lord, make yourself clear, abundantly clear, and help us just to grow as we see you aright. In your name we pray. Amen. So turn, if you will, in your Bibles to Psalm 105. I'm going to read the first, 20 verses or so. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, call upon his name, make known his deeds among the peoples. Sing to him, sing praises to him, tell of all his wondrous works. Glory in his holy name. Let the hearts of those who seek the Lord rejoice. Seek the Lord and his strength. Seek his presence continually. Remember the wondrous works that he has done, his miracles and the judgments he uttered. O offspring of Abram, his servant, children of Jacob, his chosen ones. He is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. He remembers his covenant forever, the word that he commanded for 1,000 generations, the covenant that he made with Abraham, his sworn promise to Isaac, which he confirmed to Jacob as a statute, to Israel as an everlasting covenant, saying, to you I will give the land of Canaan as your portion for an inheritance. When they were few in number, of little account, and sojourners in it, wandering from nation to nation, from one kingdom to another people, he allowed no one to oppress them. He rebuked kings on their account, saying, touch not my anointed ones, do my prophets no harm. When he summoned famine on the land and broke all supply of bread, he had sent a man ahead of them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. His feet were hurt with fetters, his neck was put in a collar of iron, until what he had said came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. The king sent and released him. The ruler of the people set him free. He made him lord of his house and ruler of all his possessions to bind his princes at his pleasure and to teach his elders wisdom. Then Israel came to Egypt. Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. And the Lord made his people very fruitful. He made them stronger than their foes. He turned their hearts to hate his people, to deal craftily with his servants. He then sent Moses, his servant, and Aaron, whom he had chosen. They performed his signs among them and miracles in the land of Ham. He sent darkness and made the land dark. They did not rebel against his words. He turned their waters into blood and caused their fish to die. Their land swarmed with frogs, even in the chambers of their kings. He spoke, and there came swarms of flies and gnats throughout their country. He gave them hail for rain, fiery lightning bolts through their land. He struck down their vines and fig trees and shattered the trees of their country. He spoke, and the locusts came, young locusts without number, which devoured all the vegetation in their land and ate up the fruit of their ground. He struck down all the firstborn in their land, the firstfruits of all their strength. I'll stop right there. This psalm helps kind of frame the story of God's people, the story of God's working with God's people, especially as we'll start to see it develop tonight. And then even in the next couple weeks, what we'll see is one of the things we're trying to do in this class, but also as we, as God's people, try to do through biblical theology, is understand how themes are developed over time in the Bible. And so Today, hopefully, or tonight, I should say, we'll start to really see how some of these bigger themes that are in the book, The King and His Beauty, that are in different things we've read, that will start to hit over and over again, week in and week out, start to progress, if you will. Last week was like highly introductory, which is awesome. And yet, at the same time, we'll start to get into kind of the meat of what God has said and how he is developing. What's up, Cody? Sorry. You should never call people out when they walk in late. I'm sorry. It's just terrible. So a couple of things real quick. Before we jump into today's text, just by way of review, last week we talked through kind of what we're doing in this class in terms of biblical theology. We're trying to understand how God has revealed himself progressively over time. We talked a bit about kind of the four-chapter story, kind of creation, fall, redemption, and then restoration, how the story of the Bible is kind of this unfolding drama of how God has created, how mankind has broken all creation through sin, how through Jesus God is redeeming a people for his name and his glory, and then long-term, how God is restoring all creation to the way it's supposed to be. And then through that lens, we're kind of walking through the story of the Old Testament, looking at it through the lens of the king and his kingdom, the king and his glory, the king, as Tom Schreiner has written in his book, the king and his beauty, if you will. Just trying to understand that this picture is a story about a king, his kingdom, his people. That's not the only metaphor you could use, but that's the one we're using just because it's sticky and it's helpful in many respects. So all that being said, did you guys get to read some of the passages just so I have a gauge as to how much we need to read them together? I just want to be like clear. Did we get to read some of the passages? If you weren't here last week, I understand you probably didn't read the passages. So that's cool. Yeah, shaking your head. No big deal. Andrew probably didn't read any either. No big deal. Great. That's really helpful. Okay, so as we do that, I'm not going to write anything up here yet. Let's jump into our Bibles. Are there any questions about what we talked about last week, just as you guys have kind of percolated on a syllabus, which sounds terrible. Gosh. Any questions? That's good. That's fine. Okay. Some ground rules before we do get started. Bathrooms are right out that door. Food and drink, feel free to get up at any time to go to the bathroom or to get food and drink. There will be a break. We'll have a break in 20 minutes, 25 minutes or so. Feel free to ask questions throughout, but let's jump in. Let's look at what God has said in his word. So if you will, let's go back to Genesis 1 and talk through a little bit more of Genesis 1 and 2 as we just seek to understand really the foundation of what God has laid as we seek to understand him and his word. You guys are probably like, wow, we talked about Genesis 1 for like a class and a half. But Genesis 1, what's up? Andrew, another Andrew. See? Andrew, Andy, Andrew, Andrew. Whoa. Like, statistically in this class, we take up over a third, I think.
More half the dudes.
Yeah. That is wild. How old are you, Andrew?
25. 36.
41.
Okay. So, like, we are a little bit more, well, I don't know. I kind of bridge the gap between us.
He's the new generation. I'm
32, yeah. Huh. The next generation. Okay, Genesis 1. Let's pick up, because we've already talked through a number of these passages, but let's pick up in verse 26, Genesis 1, verse 26. Then God said, Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And then he'll go on to say very similar things in terms of what this dominion really looks like. And so we see here in this passage, we get this glimpse of the king who is not only jealous for his glory, which we talked about last week, but a king who works and he guards. I feel like I lost where I was going with that. A king who works and he guards. I've got the wrong passages. Why? That makes more sense now. I don't know where I was going to go with that. So the language of works and guards, this piece where it says be fruitful and multiply in verse 28, that's where I was going to go. Sorry, so thrown off. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. So God gives this command to bear fruit, essentially to have babies, because as we talked about last week, God creates man and woman, we see here in this passage, as image bearers. So mirrors that reflect the glory of God. And then he gives us a command to bear fruit, to multiply, in order that his glory might be mirrored, might be reflected, might be expressed throughout all the land. And so God's dominion covers everything that he creates. And yet the way in which he chooses to see his glory go out into the land, to see his dominion go out into the land, is through these image-bearing people, essentially. And then later on in Genesis chapter 2, he gives this command to Adam to work and to keep the garden. That's where I was going with work and to keep. I was like, where was I going with that? Like, I have no idea. He gives them this command to work and to keep the garden. Or the language there could be translated to work and to guard the garden. So he gives them this cultural mandate. Sometimes you'll hear about this language of a cultural mandate where God creates things, but mankind is tasked with making sense of God's creation, with actually filling the earth and subduing it, bringing the reign and the lordship of the king to bear upon all things that he has created. And so in our work, in our relationships, in our art, in our food, in our everything, essentially, our task as image bearers is to actually bring kind of the reign of God, the lordship of Jesus, to bear upon all things. And this is in the garden. This is giving us a picture of what God's design for these things actually is. John Frame, one of the theologians that Neil's using in his class, like his big book, that huge white book you'll see around Park once in a while, it's like 9,000 pages. He said, creation is what God makes. Culture is what man does with creation. And we believe very strongly at Park that part of our task as the church is to influence and shape, to create culture, if you will, to help form cultural norms, to help shape people toward what God loves and what God desires to see happen. And this isn't just in the form of evangelism, though it's at least that. So I want to make sure I'm very clear when I say that. Like, we believe wholeheartedly that Christians, that God's image bearers who have been redeemed by Christ are called to evangelize, to share the gospel, like, very boldly, to proclaim the good news of what Jesus has done on behalf of their sin, to reconcile them to God, right? We believe in evangelism. It's very important. But we also believe that through our work, through our families, through our relationships in general, through the art that we make, whether it's music or I keep using the exact same illustrations, but like through the food that we make, we're actually shaping and influencing culture. And so sometimes, I mean, this is a hard illustration because I love all kinds of food. How many of you guys are like foodies, foodies? You know, you like food? Oh, not many. Okay, better question. Thank you. Do you like food? Okay. Do you like good food? Okay. Do you like bad food? Okay. At least you're honest. Some people like bad food. Taco Bell. Did you guys know Taco Bell has breakfast now?
And it's amazing.
Wow. I don't know if you should be allowed to teach. It's amazing. The way we understand, like, how we make food actually, to some degree, should come under the reignship, the lordship of Jesus, because Jesus loves good things, things that we pour our hearts into, things that we desire to see done really, really well. And while you can make the argument that, like, oh, there's a place for really bad food in the world, which there is, so let's be honest about that, there's a place for really bad food in the world, right? There's a place for Taco Bell in the world. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning after a wedding when it's the only place open, right? That's the place for it, right? Right. And yet, even our food should come under the lordship of Christ. Like, how we understand the goodness of really good food. How we delight in a gift from our God who gave us taste buds, who gave us like sense, you know, senses that we can enjoy things and delight in them, and a creative ability to take something like a beautiful ribeye steak and let it dry out for a day, and then you slap it on. Do you guys know what a green egg is? It's wonderful. A green egg is like, it'll get to like 1,500 degrees and it'll cook a steak in like 25 seconds. It is so awesome. Like, that is one of the ways in which we bring things under the lordship of Christ. Or in our work, for example, some people will think that our work is just a means to an end. To share the gospel at work is really what it means to be a Christian at work. And while, again, that is like a good and beautiful and wonderful thing to do, like we should steward the relationships we have at our place of work, God calls us as workers to do things with a level of excellence, with a level of integrity, with a level of seeing our work as a means in which we're shaping and influencing culture for the glory of God and the good of mankind. And so God calls us as image bearers, as sub-creators, if you will, to bring the lordship of Jesus to bear upon all aspects of every part of our life. And we see that here in Genesis 1:28, and we'll see that work itself out over and over again as we get through the Old Testament as well. So I want to have you guys ask a couple questions at your tables, and I want you to ask these two questions. First, before you ask questions, introduce yourself at your tables. Second, ask the question, what do you do for work? So what do you do either for... How do you contribute to the world? Because oftentimes we frame work in terms of like remuneration, but a lot of people don't get paid for what they do, but they're still contributing to some degree. And so what do you do with most of your day? Maybe that's how I'll frame it. And then on top of that, the third question is, what does the lordship of Jesus look like? And that's a really like abstract concept. I get that. If you get to that point, please, I'd love to know how you understand answering that question. But really, what do you do for work? What's your name? What do you do for work? And then we'll talk about it in just a minute. Go.
I'm over here.
How do you contribute?
Covered Genesis 1.
Okay, let's come back together. You're going to say something really good. Something really good. So, with the whole group. The whole group, please. So, maybe I can just ask, because I love knowing. What do you guys do for work?
We're all involved with in the system youth.
Say that again.
So youth who are in the system.
In the system youth. Okay.
The man, the big.
Yep, the man. Great. Multiple men. Great. There's got to be a better way to frame that. What do you guys do over here?
I'm a nurse.
Okay.
I'm a nanny and a curriculum writer for Knowledge Leaders.
Very cool.
New construction management.
Student. Stuff. Student, youth ministry. You guys?
Software engineer.
Okay.
Financial planner.
Very cool.
Help startup companies.
A startup of startups.
Yes.
I'm a startup founder, so you can help me.
That's great. Andy?
Physical therapy.
Okay, awesome. So one of the questions is that I have for you, and this is more just like for my own question is, outside of like the evangelism at work piece, how much have you guys thought about your work, just your work, purely the work that you do on a 9-to-5 basis, as one of the ways in which you're shaping and forming culture, as one of the ways in which you're bringing the lordship of Jesus to actually bear upon the world? Is that a concept? Hey, guys. No, you're fine. Seriously, jump in. Yeah. How many times have you guys... Is that something that you guys have heard? Is that something you guys have thought through? And I'm getting a lot of yeses. This is awesome. I am so thankful. Okay, so every church I've been a part of before has been like a lot of like, no, not really. That's great. So you guys have it figured out. Okay, so I'll just skip the next like 4 or 5. Okay. Let's look at Genesis 2. Can I just ask? Man, that's fascinating. I'm so thankful. Where? Where have you heard that framed? Talked through? Taught?
Where did you get the idea to think of it like that?
Sure, yeah.
Brian.
Okay.
I think it's like a new part of our church movement.
Yeah.
I
sure.
Think
Okay, so that's extremely helpful. Great. Okay, let's go to Genesis 2. Genesis 2, verses 1 to 3. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. So this isn't saying that God stopped like doing things as much as God stopped creating everything that was. And yet we see in this picture a God who takes a Sabbath rest. It's a theme we'll see developed throughout the story of the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. Eventually we'll see a picture of Jesus as the fulfillment of rest, because in Jesus we find a place of like total contentment, total peace, total perfection even to some degree, which is crazy. So on the seventh day, God rested is a picture of his perfection in that. But on top of that, what we see in this passage that is a huge theme that will get developed later, even in tonight, but over and over again in the Old Testament, is this picture of God dwelling with his people. So we don't see the picture of a king who is far off by choice from his people, who sits in the spire of his castle, you know, looking down upon his subjects, but a king who is dwelling in the presence of the people he loves, the people he serves, the people he's created. Okay, so we see a picture of the king in his kingdom with his subjects, which we will soon screw up, right? But this theme is really important because really you could argue the rest of the Bible from Genesis 3 on is a picture of the king coming to restore the relationship that he created here in Genesis 2. Genesis 1 and 2, okay? God bringing a people back to himself. God reconciling a people back to himself. God creating a relationship in a way in which we as sinful human beings can come back into his presence, can come back into the garden. And that's pictured here as what God has designed our life to be, as one where we are with him. I want to define kingdom, but I don't have it in front of me. I will in a minute. So let's look at Genesis 3. In Genesis 3, rebellion and the kingdom occurs, right? So we get this picture of everything is going the way it's supposed to be. Life in the kingdom, life in the sanctuary, life in the place where God dwells with his people is going the way it's supposed to be, right? He gives them kind of that's a terrible word. He gives them this place to live that is beautiful and glorious and wonderful, and he is there. And he tells them, you can eat of every tree that you see, every bush. You can eat, you can do whatever you want, except you cannot eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right? So he gives them this one law, this one command, this one don't, and says, yet, you can, there's another tree in the garden, and he says, you can eat from that tree as much as you want, by implication. He doesn't actually say that, but by implication, you can eat from that tree all you want. And that's the tree of life, right? Am I wrong in saying that? I think there's a tree of life there. So that being said, God says you can eat of the tree of life as much as you want. Now, what happens? Rebellion sets in. I want to read a little bit from Genesis 3, verses, whoop, go back. 3:1-6. Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, did God actually say you shall not eat of any tree in the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the tree, of the trees in the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die, which is not true. God never says you can't touch it. He says you can't eat of it, which is fascinating. She distorts the truth even in her response to the serpent. But the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. So here in Genesis 3, we have high treason. We have people rebelling against the king, saying, you have spoken us into creation. You have given us life. You have breathed? You've given us? Breathed? Yeah, for some reason that sounds wrong. You've breathed life. It sounds better. Breathed. You've breathed life into our lungs, into our nostrils. You've given us what we could not give ourselves. Yet we decide to rebel against your kingdom, against your rule, against your authority, against everything that you stand for, and do what you have said not to do. All of us have a little bit of Benedict Arnold in us, right? We all have treasonous hearts who long to do what God says not to do. And Adam and Eve aren't just like, you know, these random people who made a mistake, right? They represent us. They represent a people who long to do what God has said not to do, who long to do what God does not find, what God does not delight in. And so as we start to see the picture of God's people unfold over and over again, it seems like God's people go back to the tree, right? And we see that in our own lives. Like, we see how over and over again, you know, the Bible will say, like a dog going back to its vomit, we go back to the sin that our hearts desire. And yet, the faithfulness of God continues to amaze us as we understand what he has done through Christ. At the root of sin is disbelief. So we see here in this passage kind of the root of sin is a disbelief in God by disobeying his word, which will get fleshed out over and over again. Now, instead of listening to God, Adam and Eve listened to the serpent, right? So there's this interesting figure, the serpent, who it says is more cunning than any other. And it's kind of this embodiment of evil, if you will, later to be known as the embodiment of evil is the best way to explain that. But then what happens is the kingdom is broken. So instead of God's glory and God's goodness kind of shaping and forming the kingdom. At this point, all of God's creation is taken into a tailspin of decreation, where everything that God has created is now affected by sin. Everything that God has said is good is now broken to some degree. Now, that doesn't mean that you and I are inherently bad in everything we do. What it means is that sin actually affects every kind of faculty of our being, if you will. Shame and guilt are introduced into the world, and so they figure out that they're naked, or they realize that they're naked, and so they feel a sense of insecurity. They feel a sense of shame, of guilt, so they sow fig leaves together, and they hide from God when God comes back into the garden. So shame and guilt are introduced to a world where there was no insecurity, there was perfect security, even in total nudity, which is like hilarious to even think about. Like, you know why we think nudist colonies are really funny? It's because it's like the most awkward thing in the entire world for us to imagine, right? Like a bunch of, and it's kind of weird. It seems like everybody who lives in nudist colonies are like really fat, kind of old, weird people. I don't know how I know that. You guys knew that too, though, so I don't feel even remotely weird. It's totally true, right? She just doesn't want to admit it. But isn't it funny how that's actually a response to the fall? It's not a response to how we were designed to be. Now, that doesn't mean that, like, in eternity we're going to be naked necessarily. But what it means is that our response to our desire to have clothes is part of our covering, because we're insecure people at the heart, because we struggle to understand our identity and who God has created us to be. So sin brings shame, it brings guilt, it brings the kind of the blame game, if you will. It's fascinating. You know, God goes to Adam, he says, what have you done? And Adam goes, well, the woman that you gave me, like, she gave me some fruit and I ate of it, you know what I mean? Which is fascinating when you think about it, because Adam isn't exactly just like blaming Eve for what happened. He's functionally blaming God in his own sin, right? He's saying, the woman that you gave me drew me into this. So it brings like this relational discord that wasn't supposed to be there. In the garden, there's this picture of Adam and Eve that they've just been married. There's beauty, there's goodness. Like, obviously there's sex and goodness, because God says be fruitful and multiply. So there's intimacy with no end. It's beautiful and wonderful. And now sin brings this relational just carnage. It shatters everything it touches. And then it breaks down even the relationship between them and God. Well, on top of that, it brings death, right? So God says, if you do this, you will die, right? Sometimes at funerals, or just, you know, like when we talk about people dying, we say like, oh, they died of natural causes, right? Biblically speaking, there is no natural cause for death. It is the most unnatural thing in the entire world, because what God has actually created, he created for life, for abundance. And so sin affects everything, and it shatters, it breaks everything it touches. It's like a bull in a china shop. That's a terrible illustration. It's overused and it's childish, sophomoric. So let's look at Genesis 3, verses 14 to 15. The Lord God said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Then he goes on to kind of pronounce judgment on Eve and Adam. Okay, so God sees what happens, he calls them to account, and then he judges the serpent first. Now, he judges Adam and Eve. He says to Eve, like, your pain in childbearing will increase, okay? He says your desire, you will long for your husband. But then it goes on to say that for the husband, like, your work will be exasperated, it'll be hard, which isn't saying that, like, all work is hard and frustrating, because God gave us work to do in the garden before the fall, right? So work isn't inherently frustrating, it isn't inherently bad, but it will be exasperated by the effects of the fall, if you will. But he judges the serpent by saying, now you will crawl on your belly. And then he says that piece in 3:15, he says, I will put enmity enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. That language of offspring is really important because it's actually a singular noun. I had to think about that. It's a singular noun talking about one person. Bless you. And what we see here is the first glimpse, just the first little like peek behind the curtain of a redeemer. We get this first little kind of appetizer, this teaser of one who will bring victory over God's enemies. Okay? So we don't get a picture of Jesus fully in the Old Testament, and especially not in Genesis 3. But what we get is just this little kind of like pack it away in the back of your head kind of understanding of a redeemer, of a victor, of somebody who will come and crush the enemies of God. Okay? And that'll be important as we move on through the Old Testament. Sorry, I need to get a better way to get through this. So, sin creates kind of this relational damage, and yet we see this picture of a merciful God, because even in his judgment, God doesn't kill them right away, and God promises a redeemer. God says an offspring will come who will crush the serpent's head. Okay? I want to stop right there because now's the natural stopping point before we get into, we're going to move into the rest of Genesis. I know we've been in Genesis 1, 2, and 3 for like an hour, it seems like. Now we're going to get through the rest of Genesis. So we'll speed up the bus at this point. Now's the best time to break. So why don't we break? Real quick, let me just ask, any questions do we have about that? No? Great. Let's break right now. Okay, let's get started again. You guys look like you're in good shape. Nice. So I am so glad that you guys like each other. In all seriousness, that makes class way better when you actually like people in a class, because it means you're coming more for each other than just to hear me babble for a while. So we've seen in the first three chapters of Genesis, we've seen this picture of the king who is self-existent, who is present before time began, if you will, who spoke words and things happened, meaning he spoke creation into existence. And he created this sanctuary, this temple, this place for him and his subjects to live, to be in relationship with one another. We, his subjects, sinned against him, decreating everything that he created, sending things into a tailspin of destruction and brokenness. Sending things in, as one theologian will say, like, things are not the way that they're supposed to be. But in this, there's a promised redeemer. Ooh, that was brutal. No, you're okay. It just sounded like you had a small child in there or something.
There's no child, though.
Yeah, okay, good. That's awesome. So, for a couple who listened, a man and a woman who listened to the mutinous words, take and eat, what we'll see over the story of redemption is eventually we'll see a man sitting in an upper room with his closest friends who reverses this decreation by saying to those he loves the most, his followers, his subjects, this is my body broken for you. This is my blood shed for you. Take and eat. And really, a lot of what we see in the New Testament to the Old is a reversal of what happens in Genesis 3. It's God actually intervening in the course of history to make things the way that they were designed to be, to take things back even into the future. And so, as we talked about last week, Genesis 1 and 2 and Revelation kind of 20, 21, 22 especially, is this, these two pictures where things are the way that they're supposed to be again. Okay, so as we move on and start to look through kind of the rest of Genesis, which we will get through tonight, and then as at this point, we will start to really pick up speed. Next week and the following weeks, we'll pick up even more speed because we'll move at a much, much quicker clip. But kind of just Genesis and Exodus just really frame so much of the narrative for what we're trying to get through. The king's portion will take a huge piece of that as well. So what we'll see, if we were to read, and feel free to, but it's not, you know, my hope that you read it necessarily for the class. In Genesis, these are Genesis 1, 3, 6, 12. What we'll see is What happens with God's people, with people God's created, image bearers, is like this decreation, this sin happens. And so Adam and Eve have two sons. The first murder happens, and then they keep having children and wickedness. So when we get to Noah, basically wickedness is the word that defines people, okay? So things just keep getting worse. Like, it just keeps getting worse. Sin's effects grow deeper and deeper in the world. And eventually, God gets to this point where he's kind of like, I don't know if this is worth it, right? Like, this is ridiculous. I'm just going to wipe everything out. And yet, he decides to save a remnant. Another theme we'll see over and over again, the salvation of a remnant of people. We'll see that. I don't want to say that too much. We'll see over and over again, but that's what biblical theology really is these themes that are interwoven. And so what happens in kind of the Noah account is God saves a remnant. And then in Genesis 12, where we'll go to right now, is where God starts a new kingdom, a new people. He actually takes the words that he said to Adam and Eve, bear fruit and multiply, and God does that work for us, because we can't do it for ourselves anymore. So, pick up with me in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3, if you will. Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. Okay. Genesis 12. Now, the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. What do you think the overarching theme of this passage is? Blessing. Wow, it's amazing. There's like 32 blessings in there. So God goes to a man named Abram, and he calls him out of everything he knows. He plucks him out of his family, his kindred, his tribe, his place, which, like, for us, especially as Denverites, like, we are Denverites, thank you. We are, like, by nature transient people. Like, how many of us here were born in Denver? One. How many of us have lived here for more than 20 years besides Kristen? Okay, two. That's great. Yeah, so like leaving the place that you knew at this time in this day and age was not, it wasn't really part of your understanding of life. People didn't pick up and go places. They didn't pick up and move. They didn't just follow, you know, an epiphany of God, as it were. People didn't move around. Now, they might have had, you know, like a huge tract of land that they would, like, shepherd sheep and move around like nomads. I get that. But they didn't just, like, pick up and leave everything that they had. Okay? Like, we can, you know, put everything in our small Nissan and drive to Denver and start a new life there. And so God comes to Abram, and he calls him to leave everything he has. He tells him that he will make his name great, which in Genesis 11 in the Tower of Babel, if you know that story, what the people say in that story is, we want to make a name for ourselves. We want to make our name great. So we're going to build this you know, this leaning tower of Pisa to the heavens, and we're going to basically bring God down to us. Well, or we're going to go up to God, if you will, is probably more the picture. But God, you know, crushes that. He scatters the people. He changes their language. And then here, he calls a person out of his homeland and says, I will make your name great. So these two stories read in connection actually bridge a huge gap. Like, sometimes we read chapter 11 and then we read chapter 12 and we think that there are two divorced stories. No, they're intertwined, because the story is there. And so God says, go from your country and your kindred, your father's house, to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. So he's saying, not only on top of like this blessing, I'm going to make you a blessing, you are going to be a blessing, but I'm going to prosper you. What I told you to do in Genesis 1:28, to bear fruit and multiply, I am going to do for you. And he does. Now, what we'll see as we read through Genesis 12, which we're not actually going to do, but if you were to read through Genesis 12, is God continues to promise or develop that promise. And he promises three primary things that we'll see as we understand God's kingdom in the world. He promises progeny, or like a family, a line, descendants, children, if you will, but not just like kids, children, like a household, if you will. So he promises progeny. He promises to help them bear fruit and multiply. He promises land. So he tells him even right here to go to the land that I will show you, which he later shows is the land of Canaan, or the promised land, or the land where Israel eventually is. And then as we get to the later on kings, it's Israel and Judah, or Samaria and Judah. Say it again?
That's right.
Okay, good. Thank you. And the third thing that he promises is blessing. And we see that a lot here as well, just blessing over and over again, that through this people that God is starting through Abram, God will bring blessing to the nations. Okay? Now, at a point where it looks like this kind of image-bearing project that God has started in Genesis 1 and 2 is borderline, you know, like going down the tubes, God flips it and decides to change everything and start it on an upward trajectory. But he's the one who does it. And then what we'll see is these three kind of promises help us understand kingdom. One theologian defines kingdom. His name is Von Roberts. If you read my notes, Von Roberts is through everything. I showed you that book last week. He's really helpful. But he defines kingdom as God's people in God's place under God's rule, which is a great definition for kingdom. I'll say that again if you're like a note taker. God's kingdom is defined as God's people in God's place under God's rule. And that correlates really well with progeny, so people, land, God's place, and under God's rule is to be a blessing to some degree. And that'll get fleshed out more as the story progresses as well. So, then we move on to Genesis 22. If you will, move on to Genesis 22 with me. So Abram and his wife Sarai eventually become Abraham and Sarah. God promises to make them abundant. He promises to give them children functionally, and they're very old. And right before Genesis 22, actually, they're after Abram decides to like have kids with a concubine, and it's not the way that God designed it to be, Abraham and Sarah have a child, Isaac, the promised son. Okay, and so here in Genesis 22, unique story happens. So why don't we read together Genesis 22 verses 1 through something? After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham." And he said, "Here am I." He said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering, and he arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes. He saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young man, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went, both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, "My father." And he said, "Here am I, son." He said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." So they went, both of them together. After God has promised Abraham to bless him, to make him a blessing, he's promised to give him the land that he's come to, essentially, and to make for him a family. You have to imagine their surprise when, after God gives them in their extremely old age a child, God calling Abraham to sacrifice his only son. Imagine that for a second. You and your wife, or you and your husband, you're going to the hospital, and you go to the maternity ward, and you're checking into the maternity ward, and the nurse there says, "Oh, are you here to see a grandchild?" And you say, "No, actually, we're here to have a child ourselves." And the nurse laughs at you, and then it turns out you actually have a baby, like in your extremely old age. And everything God has given you is like this unbelievable miracle. And now, God is asking you to give up what he has given you, to give up what he has promised you, to give up what you have been longing for your entire life. Sarah was barren her entire life. And God gives them a son, a child. God has promised a family line. And now God is calling it into, not into question, but he's saying, will you bring this child that I've given you and sacrifice it? And what does Abraham do? He sharpens his knife, he gets kindling together, and he walks towards the mountain. I want you for just a minute, for 1 minute at your tables, to talk through what are some things that you've given up in your life? What are some things that you've been called to sacrifice, to leave, to let go of? What are some things that have been hard for you to say goodbye to, if you will? Go. Okay, so what were some of the hardest things that you've had to give up in your life?
Oh, you want us to share it with you now?
Yes. Yes. Your deepest, darkest secrets.
Got it. I was on them. I've had to give up like a lot of relationships just that aren't really healthy, but for me, like the hardest one was my family doesn't believe what I believe, so they've become really toxic in my life. So when I was in high school, I moved out at 16 and was like, you are people that like can't really be in my life if I'm gonna go on the right path.
Wow. That sounds extremely challenging.
It was, but I mean, I can see the fruit of what God has done in my life through that, and he's provided, like, well beyond what I needed to just, like, be a really good community. Like, my church family became my real family, and I wouldn't have it any other way, like, from where I'm sitting now, so.
Thanks for saying that. Cool. Other things we've had to give up, sacrifice, let go of. That's a hard one. It's okay. You don't have to share. Weirdly enough, in my own life. So when I was a senior in college, I just started my senior year of college, and I had been dating a girl that I was like really close friends with for probably 4 or 5 years, which was crazy. And we started dating, and it was really good, and we dated for about a year. And then my senior year of college, for whatever reason, I like sensed that I just shouldn't. And this isn't like spiritual God talk or something. Like, for whatever reason, I felt like I just shouldn't be dating her anymore. It was the weirdest feeling ever. And part of it was rooted in the fact that I was asking a lot of really weird existential questions, like, what am I here for? Why am I on this earth? And for whatever reason, I felt like I couldn't do that with a girlfriend. But it was one of those things where, like, it just was bizarre to give up somebody who cared for me so deeply, somebody who made sense in every sense of the word, somebody who, like, you know, I definitely saw myself marrying, and God definitely used that, similar to your story, Krista. But I mean, it's weird when you have to give something up that you can't totally understand. You can't, it doesn't make sense to you. And that's definitely a picture of what we get here in Genesis 22. What happens is Abraham eventually goes up the mountain. His knife is sharp. The kindling is ready. He, you know, ties his son down. And as his raised hand starts to fall, God stops his raised hand. God stops the blade, and he provides a ram, right? He provides a ram in the thicket. And what we see here is not only a picture of a willingness to sacrifice, but we see something that's inherent to the the gospel that we believe in, the God that we believe in, is that satisfaction by substitution is central to how God forms this new community, this new covenant people, this kingdom of God is shaped around sacrifice by substitution, or satisfaction, you could say, by substitution. And what we see in this text that's actually really helpful for us in many respects is faith oftentimes is exercised by obedience, even in the midst of not totally understanding what's going on. And I don't say that to say, like, my story was like me being, I had no faith. I just made a weird decision. And yet what we see with Abraham is this picture that in the midst of a situation that he didn't understand, that didn't make sense, God had promised a family, God had given him a son. When he calls him to sacrifice his son, Abraham went up the mountain, he took the knife, he took the stuff for the fire. And yet, throughout the story, if you read it, he says he believes that God will provide a sacrifice, that he will provide a ram for the sacrifice. And God does. What we also see in the story that's unbelievably helpful for us is that oftentimes Abraham is held up as this man of high faith. And that's true. He had wonderful faith. But his faith was not, the text isn't drawing our attention to like the degree of his faith or the amount of his faith, but that he trusted in the promises of God. That the object of his faith was more important than the circumstances that surrounded him. And so instead of saying, like, I just have to have faith in this situation, he said, no, I believe in a God who does what he says he's going to do. Over and over and over again. A God who says who does what he says he's going to do. We can trust him. And so there's a picture of faith exercised through obedience, especially at in Abraham's life. So now let's look at one more story before we break for the night. We've seen now kind of how God starts this new family through Abraham, this new kingdom, if you will. And then we see how God helps us understand that this new family will have, like, sacrifice will help shape it, substitution will shape it, how those things come together. And then the story of Joseph, we see a family that's redeemed by a dead brother, if you will, right? And many of us grew up, or some of us probably, how many of you guys grew up in the church? Just okay, cool. Decent amount of us. So many of us probably grew up hearing, you know, the story of Joseph and God's faithfulness to Joseph and those things in this story. But the story of Joseph is a fascinating story when you read it. It takes up a huge portion of Genesis. Massive portion of Genesis. And so for us to understand it is extremely important for a number of reasons. So the picture of Joseph is one where Joseph is a brother, one of 12 brothers. His father, Jacob, loves all of his sons, and yet he loves Joseph the most, if you will. And Joseph has this dream, right, where Joseph essentially is being worshipped or bowed down to by his brothers and his parents, if you will. And his brothers don't like that, which makes sense, right? They don't enjoy knowing that they're the second youngest brother, if you will, is the one who will actually reign over all of them, who will lead over all of them. And so they plot to kill him. They recognize, hey, we could kill him, or we could make some money off of him, which is great. Like, instead of killing people, we should make money off of them. We should enslave them. So they sell him to a group of Ishmaelites. They make some money off of him. They take his multicolored coat, his beautiful coat, if you will, the coat that signifies his father's beautiful love for this son, and they, you know, they shred it up and they act like an animal killed Joseph. And Joseph is taken as a slave. He goes to kind of a an Egyptian noble is probably the best way to say it, Potiphar. In Egypt, kind of a man with a lot of power, and he serves in his household, and eventually he's accused of adultery within the household with the wife of Potiphar, and then he gets thrown in jail, right? And within the confines of jail, he meets a couple guys. He he interprets their dreams for them. One of them he interprets to death, which is too bad. The other he interprets to life, which is great for that guy. And 2 years later, after that guy is released from jail, Pharaoh has a dream. And the cupbearer remembers, oh, there's this guy in jail with me, Joseph, who interprets dreams. We should bring him here. And he interprets the Pharaoh's dreams. And he's spot on with he kind of has a knack for interpreting dreams. And he interprets Pharaoh's dreams. And Pharaoh says, hey, I should give you more power in my land. And functionally what happens is Joseph becomes the king. Now, there's still a Pharaoh, but what we see in the text is that Joseph actually rules and reigns over all of Egypt, which is very powerful at this time. And then a famine breaks out, which was part of the dream that the Pharaoh had. And Joseph's father, Jacob, and his brothers send to Egypt to say, hey, we could really use some subsidy right now because we're struggling. There's famine in our land. We want to keep our line moving forward. We want to keep our family alive. Can you give us something to eat? And Joseph's brothers come to him. And that's where we will pick up in Genesis 45. So Genesis 45, verses 4 and following. So Joseph said to his brothers, come near to me, please. And they came near. And he said, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all of Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. So Joseph has all the power in the world, and instead of killing his brothers, which he could easily do, he chooses to save them. The brother that they knew as dead, as gone, as no more, is now the one who rules over arguably the biggest superpower in the area, the one who controls where food goes in a time of massive famine. They had been stockpiling food up, so now everybody's coming to Egypt saying, hey, can you give us a little? And they can sell it, and they can make way more money. And here, his own brothers, his own family come to him and say, can we have some food? And what does he do? He reveals who he is. And they get nervous. They eventually get nervous, which is humorous, but makes sense. They get nervous that he's going to off them because he should, right? They sold him into slavery. And instead of offing them, he saves them. And he says, go get my father. And he brings his family down. And he brings them down to Egypt. And so this story is unbelievably unique because what we see is this, the way that God works through even the smallest decisions of people. Frequently this story will talk about how Joseph does something, how Pharaoh does something, or not Pharaoh, but how his brothers do something. And yet, what Joseph says there at the end is crazy. He says, verse 8, so it was not you who sent me here, but God. Joseph understands that everything that happens in this world somehow comes back to God. Now, depending on how you understand God's sovereignty, like at Park, we think we have a very high view of God's sovereignty because we think it runs through the entire Bible, because we think it's something that you have to hold in tension with man's responsibility. And this picture, this picture in Joseph's life is extremely compelling in helping us understand that while we make moral, conscious decisions, God is always working to bring redemption. God is always working through the purposes and decisions of people. And yet at the same time, what we'll eventually see with Pharaoh in the Exodus is that God hardens people's heart. That sometimes when God speaks and his word comes to people, people's hearts are hardened and they have decisions in that too. And yet somehow God is working through that. Yet in this story, God is always working to save the line. So Joseph is not the family line that eventually leads to Jesus, the promised one, the Messiah, the Redeemer, the one who is promised to crush the serpent's head. Joseph is not that line. Judah is. And so Joseph couldn't just, he had all the power. It wasn't like he was thinking like, oh, I need to save Judah so that Jesus can eventually come. He's not thinking those things. But God is, and God works that the line of Judah is saved, that the people of God at this point works and continues. And so God will stop at nothing to preserve the family line. Now for us, one other thing I just want to highlight before we go home, and then we'll get out of here, is that the picture also presented in the story of Joseph is one where God is always with his people, even in the hard times. So we saw that God called Abraham to unbelievable faith in just a really weird situation. Here what we see is the text will say over and over again that God was with Joseph. But it doesn't just say that God was with Joseph when Joseph was rising to power in Egypt. It says that while Joseph was in the cell block, interpreting dreams, years away from his rise to power, that God was with him even in that moment. So we see again this restoration of God's dwelling with his people, a restoration of what was present in Genesis 1 and 2, what was broken in Genesis 3. God is bringing a people back to himself, and he's with his people through this over and over again. God is with his people. So in these three stories, we see God calling a people to himself in Genesis 12. Abraham, a man whom through whom all people will be blessed. A man through whom kind of like that command to bear fruit and multiply. God is doing that through Abraham. But then in Genesis 22, we see a loving father, right? A father who is willing to give up everything he has, the one he loves more than anything, his only son. He's willing to sacrifice for his kingdom, for his people. And then here in Genesis 45, we get a picture of a dead man, of a dead brother, who comes back to life in order to save his family, in order to save those whom he loves. All these things, these stories we come back to over and over again. These are all real stories, true stories that really happened, things that actually happened in space-time history. And while these people that this was happening to didn't know it, they're all giving us these glimpses, these tastes, these like Baskin-Robbins little pink spoons, if you will, of a Redeemer who is going to come to save a people for His name and His glory. A God who will be with His people, a God who will call people to tremendous faith, but not because of anything they've done, but because of who He is and what He has said. We get a picture, we continue to get a clearer picture of who Jesus is and what He has done, even through the Old Testament. So, I want to leave a little bit of space. What questions do we have before we close, before I pray? What questions do we have about these passages? Any questions? It's okay if we don't. Cody.
I know this one might be a little bit specific, but in Genesis 45, it makes references specifically to Benjamin, like Benjamin's given more clothes and more money. I was wondering, is there a reason why?
Joseph and Benjamin were blood brothers. Okay. So one of Jacob's wives, Leah, right? Yeah, Leah's, so like his chosen wife of his multiple wives, which is a problem. We get that. But she had Benjamin and Joseph. So Benjamin was his blood brother. So they were close. Yeah. I have half siblings, and I love my half siblings, but my blood brother, it's weird. We have a different relationship. I don't know what that's, I mean, don't tell them that.
I wasn't here last week, and you just kind of alluded to it, but are you going to at all talk about some of the, kind of challenges in the Old Testament with concubines, multiple wives, slavery, and that type of thing? Are you going to discuss all that at all in the coming weeks?
Yeah, that's a great question. I wasn't planning on dealing with a lot of the challenges, more just because that's unimportant, but it's not exactly one of the purposes of what we're doing. But I'd love to walk through anything. Any questions you have? I mean, so we get a picture in Genesis 1 and 2. So for example, like concubines, we get a picture in Genesis 1 and 2 of what marriage is supposed to look like. The concept of slavery, man, this is just, these are like huge cans of worms. I don't know if it's worth that I actually jump into them right now. But
I
that being said,
class not the best time, but in your response to the other question, you kind of alluded to multiple wives is kind of a problem, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you can quickly make sense of a lot of those things. Those aren't necessarily God's design, but they were happening. And so for some of them, you know, it's not as though they're prescribed, they're described. So it's not as though the Bible's saying this is how it should be, instead of saying this is what is, if that makes sense. Yeah. Similar in the New Testament where it talks about suffering. We're not supposed to go looking for suffering, yet we're supposed to kind of expect that it happens because we live in a fallen world. So, yeah, that's a great question. But I'd love to field any specifics that you have.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, kind of reading through it, some things that, you know, I'm looking for other resources to try to interpret, and it's a little bit hard to reconcile sometimes. Particularly,
sure.
You know, some of the discussion around, you know, laws around slavery or,
sure.
You know, hey, it's okay to have a slave and you won't be punished unless, your slave dies, but if your slave lives after a day or two, then you're in the clear type of thing. It's like, I don't really know how to make sense of that.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Of course, slavery back then was different, too, because it was more like a worker-employee relationship sometimes. Like, if you had debt, you could enslave yourself to somebody to pay off your debt, for example. It wasn't necessarily like you took this race and made them slaves.
Right, so...
God never condoned slavery.
Right, God never condoned slavery. It was definitely happening in parts of the Old Testament and the New, for that matter. The picture of slavery that we understand as slavery is different from what most of what was happening in the Bible actually was. So indentured servitude is probably a better word. It in no way, that doesn't like automatically make it better, though. But it's a different picture. Yeah, so other questions? Those are good. Okay. We can go. Great to see you guys. See you guys next week. Let me know if there's anything I can help with throughout the week.